I have like a running list of small ideas that I really want to try in the kitchen, but it's sometimes it's hard to get through the list because you need the time, you need to collect ingredients. It's like a special project. But sometimes mm-hmm. you just get the opportunity, everything comes together and you get to try this idea. So I've had one, it's been floating around basically since our 11 Madison Park conversations. Cause I look at, either in books or in the restaurants, see these really, really interesting and beautiful presentations of torchon of foie gras. So there's like, obviously like the classic clean cylinder shape, but then some of them mm-hmm. are like, say, crusted with seeds on the outside or like wrapped in at per se, we had, it was called like pastrami wrapped torchon foie gras. So it had like this thin piece of cured beef wrapped around it. It looked really cool.
Crazy.
There's the ones in 11 Madison Park where they like, when the torchon is like, when they've deveined it and pressed it into the slab shape, they like dust it with some kind of like, say like freeze-dried berry powder or something, and then right. roll it up so that when you slice it,
so it has
it,
like this red veiny kind of,
yeah, totally, like a marble
striations going vein. Through it. Yeah
exactly. So And those are all cool, but foie gras costs $110 a kilo. and we've talked about our mutual love of chicken liver mousse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I wonder if you can like make chicken liver mousse, chill it down to the kind of like malleable buttery stage, and then treat it like a torchon of foie gras, and then apply some of these interesting presentation techniques.
That's interesting.
And I finally got to do that this week, and it worked quite well. It took some tricks, but made a in quotation marks, a torchon of chicken liver mousse. So it's pretty exciting.
That's cool. Did you decorate the interior of it in any way, or
not for this? For the first one, like, it was almost like just a proof of concept where we want to make sure that we can get the clean cylinder and make sure it's sliced, like it has the perfectly round shape and slices well. And we did we rolled it in like a spiced crushed pumpkin seed, sunflower seed mixture. So cool. It has like a cool, perimeter kind of in the cross section. But I would love to try that's the next step, is to try those, the interior
like kind of colored freeze-dried berry, something. Yeah. Interior garnish.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. So did you just use like you got it to a state where it was like soft-ish or malleable? Did you do that after you made it and chilled it, or did you do it on the way to it being chilled?
I had one method that I tried, and then someone who was working in the lab had a second, probably much smarter idea for it. Okay. So basically out of the Vitamix, so like when it's still in its, you know, pourable state,
liquid. Yeah.
My initial idea was we have lots of terrine, like steel terrine molds that have rounded bottoms. So I lined those with plastic, poured the warm liquid mousse mixture into that mold.
Yeah.
And then put it in the fridge. And then as soon as it was firm enough, I just took the plastic and rolled it into a torchon and then wrapped it in foil. Gotcha. And chilled it down. And I kept, once it was in foil, I still chilled it in that rounded bottom mold so that it had the perfectly round bottom and it didn't like get flattened where it was sitting on the counter.
That's smart. Does that make sense? Why did you wrap it in foil?
Because it's more
rigid.
Thinking was that, it's more rigid and it would help.
That's interesting.
Help it stand up. But I think that if you wrap it tightly enough in plastic, it's probably fine. Or wrap it in plastic and then like hang it so that you don't get the flat bottom. But then the coworker had the much smarter idea of using that. We have those like plastic, those dry plastic casings for air drying salami and stuff, or like shaping certain kinds of salami.
Oh, okay.
And so they just tied off one end of that and then dumped their mousse mixture into the casing, tied the top and hung it in the fridge to cool. And it was easy, fast, better.
So, that's cool. That's good. I suppose it's nice to have both methods at your disposal, because if you don't have those casings, then
totally.
And you still need a way to do it, then I wonder. That all makes sense. I wonder, like, after it's cold, if you try to go in the other direction, like if you
if it's thermal reversible, like chill it, and then you're able to temper it and make it workable again. I bet you could.
Yeah, maybe. I wonder if a lot of the air would come out or something, but yeah.
Oh yeah, that's true. This was a style.
You have to push it around quite a bit.
Yeah. It doesn't have, like, we didn't like fold in whipped cream. There's cream in it, but it's not like whipped and folded in. So it's not super delicate.
So it's not super airy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a cute idea. Am I going to get to eat some of that when I come in and try your menu?
It's on the menu.
All right.
As of tonight. It's on the menu as of tonight, actually. Yeah.
Boom.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sedeby, and I'm here with my co-host, Shale McDonald. Hello, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Do you have any follow-up? Maybe bear-related follow-up? Because we were talking about the bear.
I do have bear-related follow-up.
Oh, good.
Is
Carmi out of the fridge yet?
A couple of things. Mm-hmm. I came home one day and my mom and my sister were watching the last episode of season one of The Bear. Mm. They were just like a little ways into it. And so I sat down and watched it with them just out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And actually, well, a couple of things. Thing one is it kind of made me want to go back and watch the whole first season again. There was a lot of stuff that I forgot and a lot of stuff that I, you know, was just not in my mind when I was watching season two. And there were a few things that I saw in that final episode where I was like, oh yeah, this changes things a little bit.
Oh really?
One of them was, I think you're right. Well, maybe I think you're right to wonder if there is going to be something romantic between Sydney and
Marcus.
What's his?
Marcus.
Marcus. Yeah.
Yeah, of course there is. The dinner.
Yeah.
She makes some pasta and fish.
Yeah,
that
dinner was pretty flirty.
Yeah,
I kind of more remembered it being like just a like friendly hangout and a meeting of the minds or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was also there for them to have a little bit of room to vent about Carmi, I think.
Totally, yeah. It was like shop talk bitching kind of, yep.
Yeah, but yeah, it was pretty flirty, although I don't know, it could still go either way for me. You know, like it wasn't over the top or something where to the point where I think that it's like simmering in the background for both of them.
Right.
I think, you know, for Sydney, it might just be I was hanging out with my friend and we were joking around or something, but mm-hmm. So that's thing one. Thing two, there's definitely like at least one shot in the last episode of season one of The Bear where Carmi's in the walk-in and then hits that emergency exit paddle to get out of the walk-in, and it seems perfectly functional, and those right. things can't really fail in the way that like even if that anyway grumble not possible to get locked in the walk-in like that. And then what was the other thing about the walk-in? So yeah, and then also because I couldn't remember how those locks, like how those emergency latches on the inside of fridges make it so that you can get out of a locked fridge. Like you had mentioned that last week and I was like, really? Like I don't remember that being the case, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I looked at like three different fridge doors this week and they all like the locking mechanism doesn't go between the latch and the latch that's attached to the door and the latch that's attached to the wall of the walk-in or whatever.
Right.
They're put in a position where if you can open the latch, they stop the handle on the outside from being able to be pulled, but you can still unlatch it using the handle from the inside, which smart. Yeah.
Makes sense.
And then the major piece of follow-up is I read a few things online about about the mystery of why Mikey put the money in the cans.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And
did you find out?
I mean, I don't think that I found anything that's like a super satisfying, like, oh, this for sure is what happened there, and there's, you know, and it's and it 100% makes sense. But I did find, I mean, I found a bunch of fan theories, but I also found a quote from an interview that the creator of the show, what's his name?
Storer.
What's his first name?
Chris Storer.
Yeah. I found an interview that he did with IndieWire, wherein he gives some sort of explanation for why, how the food got, or how the money got in the cans, and kind of why. But he didn't want to, you know, ruin fan theories either. So he's kind of vague about like what the actual intentions were. But I'll just read it to you. There's a semi-automatic electric can sealer at the restaurant, or can seamer, which is a quick process and very easy to use. Michael was most likely instructed not to put the money in a bank for a myriad of tax reasons, because he was getting this money from gangsters. That was a shale interjection there. In his scattered state, the processing of the tomato cans really felt like he was starting to build something, felt more like a plan of action to him. A safe felt too safe, too obvious. I know it sounds completely absurd, but in researching various kitchens, I was really shocked how many stories and articles I had come across or heard about where money or drugs were found in sealed aluminum tomato cans. I guess the police dogs can't smell anything over the acidic tomatoes, and I definitely think Michael had heard some version of that story somewhere. So that's what Chris Storer says in an interview to IndieWire.
Huh. You ever come across that in industry?
What's that?
Have you ever come across that in your life, your professional cooking life? Drugs?
No, neither of those things have ever happened to me, and I've never heard one of those stories. Mm-hmm. But I can see how hearing that story, or maybe hearing it more than once, you'd be like, oh my God, that's crazy, and I have to put that in my show. So
I'm never going to look at
it. But I've never worked in a kitchen with a can seamer. That's real. Like, I don't dispute the idea that maybe it exists in some restaurants. There's probably some restaurants that, yeah, like can their own sauces or something like that and sell it to their customers, or I don't know.
I'm just thinking of like back in the day, having to go pick up an order from the Italian Center and like driving down that narrow alley off 95th Street, trying to find a place to like park my car. And then what are they doing? They're unloading just pallets and pallets of Pavoncello tomatoes canned. Yeah. I wonder what's really going on there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's money in all those cans. Yeah. So then that doesn't really like solve the question or answer the question of like, you know, why did Mikey think it was a good idea to hide money that he basically got from Cicero, knowing that that money would just have to go straight back to Cicero after it was found? But I think, like, after thinking about it and after watching the final episode again, I think, like, yeah, my idea about that is that, you know, like, he didn't trust himself to not squander that money if he did, like, Mikey didn't trust himself to not squander that money if he didn't do something with it.
Right.
He didn't want to use it to pay off the suppliers that he was already like red carded from anyways. And so I think the idea was to give that money to Carmi to start something. Mm-hmm. And that, like, it didn't matter because they still had the beef. So if they defaulted on the loan that they got from Cicero, Cicero would just take the beef, but the money would still be there. And then Carmi could use that to start his own thing or something like that.
Right.
Or Carmi could use that money to pay off the debts that the beef had to Cicero or whatever, and then sell the beef or give the beef to Cicero and keep the money as seed money for another restaurant or something. That's sort of like the...
Yeah, it's the thing that
it's
just
still
makes
nonsensical,
it,
but I think he was just protecting the money from himself.
Okay, I buy that.
Yeah.
The real, like we said last conversation, the real hitch is that Cicero is so intimately involved in their family affairs that it's impossible that Carmi could use that money for anything except whatever the reason that Cicero gave it to Michael in the first place was.
Yeah, I don't think Michael thought that Carmi would be able to like sneakily take the money and do something else with it. Mm. Like, I think either way, like whether Carmi then had to give that money directly back to Cicero or like that, but then Carmi would have had the beef.
Right.
Yeah. Like if Carmi took all the money from the cans and gave it straight to Cicero, then Carmi still has the beef.
Right.
If Carmi
takes the money,
defaults on the loan, Cicero takes the beef, but then Carmi still has the money. Like, I don't think, I think right. In either of those situations, it's fine for Cicero to know that the money was still there.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
Because Cicero gets his money back.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's still weird. A really roundabout way of going about it. And I don't think the second season does much to like
no.
make the show any more like clear about where it's headed or what's going to happen in it. But another thing I was thinking about too after we talked about it was that like, isn't there some kind of like subplot that doesn't really go anywhere that has something to do with like the fire suppression and the gas systems in the restaurant being tampered with potentially yes. as like a preliminary step to like setting it up to like yes. burn it down for insurance purposes or yes. something like that.
Yep.
Yeah. That's and right. it doesn't, yep. it just kind of like falls off, right? Like we don't really find out what happened there. I guess we assume that Mikey was doing some things because he was preparing at some point maybe to burn it down, but I don't know if they address that.
They do. I think they do actually. Fack, right? That's Maddie Matheson's character, Fack.
Yeah, Fack. That's his last name.
What do they call him though? Don't they call him Fack? Or do they just do that when they're being mean to him?
I think so, yeah.
What's his real name?
Because what's his real name? Oh, God. What's his first name? I can't remember. But that's his last name. Him and his brother are both called Fack.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But like he pieces it together, right? Because he can't figure out why the fire suppression isn't working.
Yeah.
And then he's looking, what's the character's name? Oh my God. Black guy, but not
Ibrahim.
Not Ibrahim, the other one. The skinny one.
Oh. Yeah, man.
The one who has to go out to buy the forks during service.
Oh, is that? I thought it was Ibrahim that did that.
Oh, but anyway, sorry. Maybe I'm confused. But okay. So they do address that, and they do tell you that that was Mikey's plan and that he did that. He rigged the system because Fack, Maddie Matheson's character. What's his name?
Uh-huh. Neil Fack.
Neil's trying to figure out the fire suppression. He's looking at a old photo that I think Ibrahim has put up by his workstation, and it's Mikey and I can't remember, maybe Mikey and Tina and Ibrahim, and they're talking about the photo, and Ibrahim mentions something weird that Mikey did, and Neil says, well, why did he do that? And then Ibrahim's like, I don't know, he was on drugs. And that clicks, that makes Neil think of something.
Right.
And he's like, oh yeah, Mikey was really messed up. And oh my goodness. And then he screams Jewish lightning, right? Like that's so.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
So he somehow that picture and the comment, the reminder that Mikey was on drugs, helps him realize that somehow, and they don't explain that the technicalities of this, somehow Mikey rigged the fire suppression so that he could potentially, if he needed to, burn down the beef and presumably collect some kind of insurance. But
right, well, and I think like I don't know if it'll become more obvious like as the show goes on, but I think if that's part of like why he put the money in the cans or something,
right? Oh,
you know, like maybe he thought the money would survive the fire, but then,
or the cans disappear from the restaurant the night that the restaurant burns down. Oh
yeah. Yeah. Now something like somewhere. That. So if he was planning on burning it down and then, you know, that's how he was going to use the insurance money to pay back
the
debt or something.
Okay, that actually makes sense to me. However, I honestly don't think that the show is building towards that explanation. I think that
it doesn't seem like it because it seems like a very tenuous through line. Like, you know, like,
and the thing is that it's not a procedural. It's not a crime show. It's a person show. And so as long as the relationships keep developing and stuff, then we're all good. But yeah, okay. It took a while to get there, but now we're.
But I think we kind of have a.
That's small man. Mikey's smart. Oh yeah, I like that. That's
You had it all together.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I guess we'll see third season. See if they do anything with that.
Yeah. Okay.
So Alan, do we have a topic? Something to talk about?
Yeah, we're going back to the filing cabinet down here in the basement and going into the stolen menus file.
Stolen menus file in basement studio B or whatever. Yeah.
And I'm going to share some more menus that I stole from restaurants.
Let's talk about
physical printed menus. We're not talking about stealing ideas. We're talking about stealing the actual menu from the table. Okay.
Yeah. Tiki menus.
Tiki menus.
Only from,
Well, that's interesting that you say that. I don't know where that came from.
Well, I just, when I think of like menus that are like stealable, that aren't like, you know, that are just like a piece of paper or something like that. Right. And when I think of vintage menus, I think of those like tiki cocktail menus that they used to put as like placemats on tables,
right,
which they still do at the Ling Nan. And I have been there recently.
But you didn't take the menu.
No, I've seen that menu like so many times that I don't really feel that it doesn't feel rare or like it's going to go out of print to me, but maybe I should take one day.
I wonder if there's any like memorabilia, paraphernalia floating around Edmonton from the old Don the Beachcomber restaurant on Jasper Avenue. Do you think that exists
in
flea markets or antique stores around the city?
Keep your eyes peeled.
Okay, we're going to do the thing where I'm so coy and I don't really tell you anything about the menu. I just read you stuff from it.
Okay, fun.
Here's a menu. Two section headings. One is just called small and one is just called large. And here's some things from the small part of the menu.
Okay.
Okay, how's this sound? Garlic butter belly, pan-fried local ahi belly, roasted garlic, butter, ponzu, tomato, onion, sesame. $10.
$10.
Yeah.
Was this from the 80s?
I knew you were going to say that. here's another small plate from this place. Smoky sashimi, local striped marlin, kiawe smoked soy, chili pepper water, extra virgin olive oil.
Huh. Okay. Sorry, local what?
Striped marlin.
Marlin.
We're not in Edmonton anymore, Shill.
Definitely. There's no marlins around here.
What else? We got steamed clams as a small plate here. Manila clams, tomato dashi. Great idea. Great flavors. Prawn butter, herb oil, house-made bread.
Prawn butter, herb oil. Okay.
Our last small plate is crispy moy. Whole fried thread fin.
Okay.
Frisée, Waimea golden grape tomatoes, pickled garlic vinaigrette, market
Waimea
price.
Waimea golden grape tomatoes. Okay.
Our large plates. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'll read a couple. Large plates. And this is probably the best thing I ate in that vicinity. Crispy chow fun. Deep fried noodles, braised grass-fed beef, Chinese cabbages, heart of palm, five spice gravy and hot mustard.
Damn.
It was so good. Crispy chow fun.
Five spice gravy, hey?
Yeah. On fried noodles.
Yeah.
What else? How about wild boar pappardelle? Huh. Housemade tomato pasta, wild boar sausage, mizugula pesto, mizugula in quotation marks, tomato, onion, kale,
what
garlic,
is that?
Butter,
Mizuno
butter.
And arugula?
Yeah, Mizuna and arugula. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I'll add some just to give you an idea of the style of service, at the bottom of the menu it says, our food is served family style and will arrive to you as it is ready from the kitchen. We are unable to split checks for parties over four. Please inform your server of any allergies or restrictions prior to your order. Mahalo.
I knew it. you shouldn't have given that dead giveaway because I was,
I wasn't, I was
already like 95% of the way to Hawaii. So,
yeah, sorry. It's always difficult to know.
Yeah, I hear you. Cool. So this is a menu from a restaurant that you ate at in Hawaii when you were on vacation there at some point.
Yeah, that's right. This is in the city of Hilo on the Big Island of Hawaii. And it's a restaurant called Moon and Turtle. This is a menu from January of 2018. And I saved it because it was a very memorable and enjoyable meal. But I was in love with this place, Moon and Turtle, because on the island of Hawaii, even though there's big tourist resorts and stuff like that, the dining scene outside of resorts is like really low key. And to me is like not even as contemporary or ambitious as Edmonton.
Right.
And so to come across this place, Moon and Turtle, was basically a Hawaiian version of Three Boars at the time. It was like cocktails, small plates, menu changes all the time, really fun ideas, fun food to eat. But I just loved, it's like so Hawaiian, and they're able to draw on really unique local ingredients like the seafood, the hearts of palm, and like incorporate the like Chinese and Japanese influences on the island. Like it was, I just thought such a fun menu and such a fun place to eat. And I stole the menu.
Cool. Do you know who was the chef there?
No idea.
When you ate there?
No idea. I don't even know if it's still open or what. This was a lifetime ago, even though it was only 5 years ago.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. There was like a fancy chef from Hawaii who was on a season of Top Chef, I think.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Don't remember his name off the top of my head, but I think he still works in Hawaii, although I don't know if he is still doing fine dining. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that sounds interesting. I think every one of the small plates has fish on it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because it was ahi belly, marlin, sashimi, clams, and the thread fin.
Yeah. Those are just like little tiny oily fish. I don't know what those are. You're going to Google it.
Yeah. I didn't eat that, but... sorry, what was your question? Are they tiny oily fish? Well, actually, Shale, they range in length from 11 centimeters to 2 meters. So they can...
Oh, that's not small. That's big enough.
Yeah. One of the cool things on this menu, and I'm trying to think if we saw it on other ones, but it would be fun for someone to really lean into for a Hawaiian terroir concept, that sashimi was kiawe smoked soy, and kiawe is like the Hawaiian, it's like mesquite brush basically that grows all over the rocky parts of the island there. And so yeah, to use that to smoke, so here they're just smoking soy, but they do have true like wild boar and wild goat there. So to like smoke that over kiawe is like would be a cool terroir kind of technique.
Yeah, totally. And I guess they're allowed to use the boar. I wonder if the boar that's on the menu is wild or if it's like they just get it in and out.
I removed some of the producer names that were included on the menus because I wasn't sure if they'd be giveaways or what. It does say Kulana wild boar.
Oh, right. So that's the name of a farm probably.
Yeah, I would think so. I don't think because I don't think it's the name of a region or anything. Like I think they would just be farmed boar.
Yeah. I mean, I'd imagine so.
And I really
never know what you're going to get with those forest boar.
That's right. I think, well, I mean, like in lots of areas, they're pests. And so you can actually, you can help them without tags and stuff like that. So,
yeah, totally. I'm sure they get hunted and used in like home settings.
Oh, absolutely. Whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah,
maybe not for restaurants.
Yeah.
Or I don't know, maybe some restaurateurs do, but they're not supposed to. I don't know. I wonder, wonder what that's like there.
I really like the notes are at the bottom of the menu, like saying that it's the food is served family style and it comes when it comes. And that's just like so
keep your hat on.
Typical of that style and that age, right? Because I think Three Boars had notes like that too. It's like something cheeky like requests for modifications are politely denied or something like, you know what I mean? They're like, this is our food, this is what we want to make, you're gonna get it when it's ready, it's gonna come whenever we want. Do you know what I mean? It was like a kind of refutation of the old ideas of hospitality, and it's like, no, we're the chefs, we know what the food should be.
Yeah, you're coming here because you want to try something, you're gonna try it how we want it or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is like, I don't know, I think it was a pretty prevalent kind of idea or concept when I was coming up, mm-hmm. was, you know, like who would order a steak that's like cooked a different way than how the chef would want to serve it you know, like, and it's a very, it's a very back of house centric philosophy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, depending on the restaurant, I can see it making sense in some contexts. But where it doesn't really hold up is when it brushes up against people's like allergies or real dietary concerns, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. Like, and I think the back of house answer for that in a lot of cases is, well, like order something else.
Right. Yeah.
But that's kind of customer hostile. And so I've never really in any of the restaurants that I've worked in, like, I mean, there have been circumstances wherein there were like things that we couldn't change about the food. Mm-hmm. But I think in most of the restaurants that I've worked in, we've tried to be relatively accommodating if there's a change that we can make that's like, you know, not that difficult, but it makes it so that someone can eat the dish.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, totally fine. Try and alter the dish in a way that will work for that person. If you are taking away something that is going to, you know, change the way the dish presents or tastes or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. try and find a substitution that's going to be reasonable. Be creative, people.
Be hospitable. You're in the hospitality industry, for goodness sake.
Exactly. it's tricky on the other side too, though, because, you know, there sometimes aren't changes that you can make to a dish to make it worthwhile, and sometimes people ask for the craziest modifications and you're just like, well, you know, like, can you take for this from this dish and put it on a plate with this from this dish? And
we've done that actually, like, it's crazy. Sorry, it's not crazy. Yeah, sometimes guests will try and do that, like they'll pick and choose, like build their own plate kind of thing. But we do that to accommodate, like in the kitchen, to accommodate requests. Like, for instance, we have a dish right now that is, it's like marinated chilled seafood that is on a savory onion custard. And so the dish is dairy, like it's like half of the calories in the dish are from dairy in the custard. But someone really wanted that dish, but dairy free. And so it's okay. Well, then it's just like some little pieces of seafood on a plate, basically.
Yeah. It's just like some garnishes. Like, yeah.
But then it's a kitchen. We've got like 100 different components for the menu. And so we just ransack all the other dishes and it becomes something else. It's like, yeah, it's still marinated seafood, but now there's like pickled fennel and orange segments and whatever else on it. And
Yeah, exactly. It's not usually that hard. It can be tricky if you're like, you know, in a real time crunch to do things. And the thing that you're being asked to do can cost you a lot of time. Like, that's obviously tricky, but
that is definitely the hardest part. the time, the time to think.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you don't even have time to conceptualize how you might fix something, or your brain is so overloaded with just keeping all of the things that you currently have cooking, you know, like keeping track of those things or whatever. It's tough to like remove yourself from that for a second and not get distracted and wreck someone else's food or whatever. Yeah. But yeah. Okay.
Want another one?
Sure. Actually, what was your, you only had one main, I'm assuming, or did you go there more than once?
Just once. We had the pappardelle and the crispy chow fun, double noodles.
Oh, okay.
Noodles and noodles. Yep. Yeah.
And the pappardelle was with?
So wild boar sausage, mezugula. Mezugula sounds like a villain name from a, or like some kind of king that tried to conquer Greece or something. King Mezugula? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Cool. And how was the pappardelle? Handmade?
Yep. Good. Yeah, it was great.
Okay. Cool. And sorry, what was the name of it again?
Moon and Turtle.
Moon and Turtle
in Hilo, Hawaii.
Well, I'll have to remember that if I ever go. If I ever go, I'm probably going to try to go to Maui, but I don't know. I don't know if people are allowed to go to Hawaii anymore.
Because of fires?
Yeah, fires and sickness and all kinds of stuff. It's complicated, sickness? I think.
Oh.
Well, yeah, for a while, they didn't want anyone coming because of COVID, but then they also did, but then there's like, you know, some dispute between like Hawaiian, Native Hawaiian people and, you know, capitalist tourist services and stuff like that. And there's just like some ongoing sort of like, I guess, dispute about what's good for Hawaii and.
Right. You know. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think. Yeah. Like on some level, that exists in almost any place that where tourism makes up such a big part of the economy. But yeah, and it's especially it's like especially complicated and serious when there's obviously like questions about race and imperialism and stuff like that with Hawaii's history. So yeah, I get it.
Yeah, still love to go though. I'm sure it's beautiful and I'm really excited about the food and I'm really into seafood and it all seems really fun and Japanese and Chinese influences in the food there.
Yeah,
I'm just like every time I see people eating there I'm kind of like, ooh, that looks pretty good.
Yeah. But,
yeah
it's a special place.
Yeah.
Can I read?
And the fruit, I'd be really excited to eat the fruit. Oh my god.
Yeah, that's just breakfast is just like the best papaya and lychee and rambutan you've ever had in your whole life and a cup of coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. What else do we got?
Okay. I want to read you another menu.
Okay.
And I'm going to, it's the chef's tasting menu from this restaurant.
Okay. That's exciting.
And there are
always eminently stealable as well because it's usually just on a paper card.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 8 courses. Some of the courses you have a choice.
Okay.
Okay. Your first course is Royal Ocetra Caviar with Japanese sea urchin, soft tofu puree, nasturtium leaves, and a Persian lime granny tea. Okay.
Okay. That's fancy.
For the second course, you have a choice between a garden cucumber salad, which has Hawaiian hearts of palm. What? Oh, sorry. Hawaiian hearts of peach palm. I guess that's a kind of palm. I've never heard of that. Medjool dates, cilantro, and padron pepper puree. That's the cucumber salad. Okay. Or for a $100 supplement, you can have the ricotta and black winter truffle annulati.
Okay, I'll have that, please.
Okay, it's $100 extra in addition to the prefix. Okay.
Yeah, no worries. In this hypothetical universe, I have $100 extra.
Okay. Well, just so you know, the annulati comes with wilted romaine lettuce, crispy shallots, and shaved Australian black winter truffles. Okay.
Australian?
Yeah, that's
for $100.
Yep.
All right. I hope they're good.
The best. The third course is an applewood smoked bacon wrapped Gulf Coast cobia. That's a kind of fish.
Applewood smoked bacon wrapped.
Applewood smoked bacon wrapped Gulf Coast cobia. If if Daniel Hume were writing this menu, it would just say cobia, but not this yeah. chef. This is Applewood smoked bacon wrapped Gulf Coast cobia.
Yeah, that's like really. I mean, I'd be shocked if it wasn't the bacon that was Applewood smoked.
Yes,
but you could read it either way, and I bet there's no comma separating it out.
There's no punctuation of any kind.
okay,
that cobia is served with Sun Gold tomatoes, fino verde basil, toasted brioche, and garden tomato butter.
Tomato butter, hey, that sounds nice.
Yeah, your next course is a George's Bank sea scallop poêlée. You know what a poêlée is?
No, I don't think so.
It's basically like butter basted in a pot. That's all it means.
Oh, okay.
It's classically with poultry, but this is a George's Bank sea scallop poêlée. And it's served with a Lorette potato puree, chanterelle mushrooms, watercress salad, and a blanquette de champignon.
Mmm. I like blanquette de champignon.
Yeah. Your next course is Four Story Hills Farm Poulard, which I think is a chicken, a certain kind of chicken.
It sounds like it could be a cross between a chicken and a duck, but I'm going to assume that's not.
Creamed garden chard, caramelized black mission figs, and sauce Périgourdine.
Oh, any idea what that is?
Black truffle sauce.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like Périgord truffles. It's like a reduction sauce that's very truffles.
Oh, I see. Périgourdine. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
Next course, you have a choice again. You can either have the herb roasted Elysian Fields farm lamb, which comes with braised pinquito beans, caramelized cauliflower, Meyer lemon confit, and crushed caper jus, or
pinquito beans.
Pinquito, like Spanish.
Pinquito?
Pinquito, pinquito, like little pinko. Pinquito.
Like little pinky toes?
Maybe that's what it means in Spanish. I don't know.
Maybe that's what it is.
I'm never going to look at a bean the same way again. Or guess what? For a $100 supplement for this course, you could have a charcoal grilled Japanese Wagyu.
Oh.
With Santa Rosa plums, garden turnips, cutting celery, and sauce au poivre.
Cutting celery?
That's what it says.
Celery that you use as a knife. Interesting. Okay.
So yeah, you get to choose between roast lamb or Wagyu beef.
Okay.
They don't say the cut of the Wagyu. Next course is your cheese course. You're being served a cheese called Pleasant Ridge Reserve. Served with garden fennel, slow roasted beets, Marcona almonds, and a fennel pollen shortbread.
Fennel pollen. Interesting. Okay.
And then lastly, you have an assortment of desserts, fruit, ice cream, chocolate, and candies. There you go. That's your 8-course chef's tasting menu.
Okay. Where did it come from? Okay. Can we play hot and cold?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you've got are you talking about geographically?
Yeah. I'm talking about where is the restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, we've got Australian truffles. We've got Gulf Coast cobia. We've got Japanese Wagyu. We could be anywhere in the world, really.
Okay, I'm going to guess California.
Yes. I thought we were playing hot or cold. You're hot. You're hot.
I'm hot. I'm burning up. Okay, yeah. That's kind of what I figured.
Yeah, it's from California.
Yeah. We don't have to narrow it down too much from there. I mean, it's either going to be San Francisco or LA, right? Oh, really? Oh, Napa?
Yes. Well, it's in Napa County. It's not in the town of Napa. It's in...
No. Yeah. I'm just kidding. Okay.
Yes, it's in Napa County.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's as specific as I can get.
Yeah, it's from... What's the town? Yountville? It's the It's the French Laundry.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was, but it's 8 courses seemed a little small for a French Laundry menu to me. And also I don't know, maybe I wasn't paying it enough attention, but yeah, I didn't recognize any of the dishes. So I'm a little surprised about that.
I played one trick. Okay, so two things. First of all, I played a horrible trick on you, and I withheld the description of one of the courses because it would be a dead giveaway. So for your first course, which I told you about the Royal Ocetra Caviar as the first course, you actually had a choice. Yeah. You had a choice between Royal Ocetra Caviar or the most famous Thomas Keller dish of all time, oysters and pearls, with a sabayon of pearl tapioca with oysters and white sturgeon caviar. So that would have given
I'm
away
glad
right
you withheld
no?
that.
Okay,
because,
And to address the number of courses, you're right. Eight courses is not what you would receive at the French Laundry or per se, but largely because this last course that's just called Assortment of Desserts is usually like four or five courses. So you'll be served something like the coffee and donuts dessert and ice cream and, you know, chocolate truffles and like a million different kinds of petit four and stuff like that. So.
And there's probably an amuse-bouche before the meal that's also not on the menu or something like that.
Yeah, that's
well, right.
And actually we did get the famous the salmon cornetti. Is that what it's called? Salmon cornet.
Right.
The little ice cream cone with salmon.
Ice cream cone. Salmon ice cream cone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Man, that's, geez. That's a place that I could still go to.
That's true.
If I wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I do want to. I would love to do that. But yeah, I'm sure it's quite pricey and quite difficult to get in these days. And so I don't know if I... don't know if I have it in me.
This was August of 2014, and that was actually the 20th year that they were open, and that like featured prominent. Oh yeah, it's right on the menu here. There's like two Roman numeral 20 kind of watermarked onto the back of this menu. And so yeah, it was difficult to get into, and it was expensive. The prefix was, so without any of those supplements, it was $295 American. But then, yeah, all of a sudden, if you want black truffles with pasta, then it's $395. And if you want Japanese Wagyu, it's $495.
Right. And sorry, did you say that's with wine? Or there's probably several tiers of wine, right?
Yeah, that's just the food. That's just...
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So... yeah, I don't know. It's funny, you know, because like on some level, I understand the appeal of a meal like that, even at that price. Like if you have to pay $500 to go and have food and wine somewhere, like I probably never would have gone down a road of learning and getting into the world of fine dining in my career if I didn't see the benefit in that. But it just seems like such a big pill to swallow now, you know? Like,
yes.
And I know I know it's more expensive than ever to get meals like that.
Mm-hmm. This was 10 years ago. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, like, I guess, like, what I'm trying to say is that I feel like in some way, like those types of price points are actually pretty low for the type of experience that is like the best in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you can go and have an experience that is like considered to be one of the best possible representations of something that you can have in the entire world, and, you know, and it just costs you a few hundred dollars, like that seems, that seems like there's good value there. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, it's still, for most people, myself included, like $300-$500 that you don't just have like lying around.
Right.
And that's, I definitely felt that when I was in Japan. Like there were places that I probably could have gone to that I didn't go to because they were going to cost me that much money to go. And like, you know, there were just... I was already surrounded by amazing experiences. You know, it just didn't seem necessary, you know, like, or something like that. So
yeah.
I don't know. I can definitely see the value. I'm sure you are like I'm sure you're really glad that you had the opportunity to go to the French Laundry and see what that's like. And I'm sure it was like an amazing learning experience for you. Was there anything that you, that happened in your meal there that you didn't enjoy or that left a weird?
The food was excellent. I wouldn't have found any fault in the food really at all. The service was surprisingly awkward.
Oh, that's too bad.
It honestly seemed like they were training new staff. Like it was like
right
stuff being brought to the table that wasn't for us, and just like awkward things like that. Yeah, but it was still like between the food and the company and all that, like it was it's not like it left with a bad taste in my mouth or anything.
It's like a memorable, it's like costly, but it's a memorable experience that you're going to have for the rest of your life, you know. Mm-hmm. So like in that way I feel like it can be totally worth it to go to an amazing restaurant and have like a really memorable experience.
I think it's something that if you have the opportunity, everyone should seek that out once or twice in their life for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't think that I, like this time, say like 10 or 12 years ago, I like sought out those experiences to the extreme. Like when we were traveling, it was like, well, the first thing we're going to do when we're planning our travels is try to get a reservation
at restaurant X.
And that's kind of like, those are the landmarks for the trip. It's like, okay, well, we have a reservation at this place on this day, so we have to be there. And then everything else kind of follows. And having had several of the experiences now, it's definitely not how I would plan a trip to California or to New York now. But those early experiences of that kind of service were amazing. Like really, really some of the most memorable meals of my life. But yeah, once you've had it, I wouldn't even want to have a meal like this every year, I don't think.
Right.
Yeah. Once you've seen it a few times.
I mean, like, if I was currently working in fine dining in something high end like that, then I would.
Right. I see.
You know, I'd want to have a couple meals like that a year because I'd want to stay like current.
Right.
And see what's happening in that scene and, you know, and see what level other people are operating at and what level I think that I can operate at or push myself to, or
totally,
you know, like then it would be really important, but it doesn't feel that important to me anymore. And yeah, when I was in Japan, I had a lot of memorable food experiences and none of them were on that scale, you know, and that there are like amazing experiences to be had in Japan that are on that level. Mm-hmm. But it didn't feel like something that I really needed to seek out. There was just so much else that I could do and be more spontaneous about, which I feel like is, you know, like more what I'm interested in now is like spontaneous discoveries and less like, oh, I heard about this thing from someone that I like something. I heard about this thing through word of mouth and I want to check it out, but like, you know, I heard about this thing because it's the best restaurant in the world. I don't know. I'm not, you know, I think I'm okay with the level of experiences that I have had already and having those be a bar and seeing what else is out there in a more spontaneous way or something like that seems more important to me now when I'm traveling.
Mm-hmm. And also like, especially because we're for this kind of menu, like, because we live in Edmonton, we're talking about traveling. Like we're not talking about, there's not restaurants like this in Edmonton. Cause you're traveling, you're spending time and money and maybe you're traveling with someone. Like how much of that precious, precious time do you want to spend sitting at this table, this, you know, through a 3 or 4 hour meal in a tie? Like it's fine. Like if that's how you want to spend the time and you enjoy doing that with whoever you're with, but like, I don't know. You want to have fun too. Sometimes these meals aren't actually fun.
Yeah. Well, I think that those experiences can be really fun, but it's tricky too. You know, like, You know, I ate at Noma with my parents, and like it's a really memorable thing that happened, you know, and we had an amazing time. But yeah, like I think, you know, there were probably times when maybe my parents or my sister, who I was always also dining with, like, you know, felt a little bit out of place or something like that, being in this, like, you know, being in this, because it's a pretty strange environment for a lot of people who haven't been exposed to it. And like, they do their best to like make everyone feel comfortable, and but it's still like, you know, it's a lot to take in. So
totally. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. It's like a super memorable thing, and I think about that a lot. But yeah, it was like, you know, basically doing that was like a whole day for us Copenhagen, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've told you the story about the beeswax cooked Arctic char in Vienna. I think this is on,
I think so.
And it's on a recording, right?
Rings a bell.
Okay. I think it's on a recording. Never mind.
Okay. I mean, maybe the listeners want to hear about it again, Alan. I don't really remember.
Just you talking about your family maybe being uncomfortable or feeling out of place in Noma. The first experience I had in a Michelin-starred restaurant was in Vienna. And the website was in German. I had to send emails in English. I was really worried that I was super nervous. I thought we were going to show up there and no one would speak English, you know, like as a starting point, we wouldn't understand anything they were saying and they wouldn't understand us. But, I thought that we would, like, I was worried about the clothes that we had brought, like, were we going to be, would they turn us away at the door? I didn't know. I was just like super nervous. To the point that when we walked in and they addressed us in German, we just kind of like smiled and nodded and were taken to our table.
And refused to tell anyone that you spoke English.
And we were served hors d'oeuvres, and they described them in German, and we went, And it wasn't until one of the early courses, and this is the famous dish at the restaurant was Steirerek, and their most famous dish is this beautiful strip of Arctic char that's brought to the table raw, sitting in a little wooden frame. They put it down on the table and they pour hot beeswax over top of the fish until it's submerged.
So cool.
And it cooks the fish on the table while you're eating some other course.
Yeah.
And then they come back to the table and they take it back to the kitchen. They pop it out of the beeswax to show it to you. And then they take it back to the kitchen and plate it. And so as they're pouring the hot beeswax over this piece of fish, they're speaking in German. I've never seen anything like this. Like, never seen really table side anything. And I start to get really worried that they're like giving us instructions on what we're supposed to do with this thing. Like, because I don't know, am I supposed to eat this? Do I eat that waxy stuff? Like what? And then we finally like stammer out like, sprach nicht gut Deutsch, or like, do you speak English, or we speak English, whatever. And then they're like, Yeah, we all speak English. Like, of course we can serve you in English. And so we went through like the first 30 minutes.
But no, that's exactly right. Like, you know, like you don't know what the expectations are going to be. And, you know, like I think that probably now, after having that experience, any restaurant you went into, you would ask if they did speak English, you know, like you would realize that it's not a big deal to ask or something.
Not to say like, you know, everyone needs to speak English. That was just one piece of the equation for us, for our anxiety about the meal. But then like, truthfully, especially once we sorted out the language thing, like they're so generous, welcoming, hospitable. They want you to be comfortable. When they do things like there's like a cheese cart or like a bread cart, when that cart comes to you, it's like you have all the time in the world. This is your cart. You can try everything on this cart. You can ask about anything on this cart and we'll tell you. Like it feels like, and you know where else I had that same feeling, Shale? Not at a Michelin-starred restaurant, but at Salt and Straw in Portland, the ice cream shop.
Oh, yeah.
You wait in line for 45 minutes for ice cream. You get to the front and I just kind of subconsciously assumed that it was going to be like rush, rush, rush. But it's like, no, You're at the front of the line. We've got 40 kinds
There's
of ice cream.
There's a person there who's specifically taking care of you. They're asking you what you like, what your dietaries are. Do you want to try anything? You can try as many things as you want. They don't make you feel rushed.
No.
Yeah.
Sample this. You think you might like that? Sample it. Here. Take this little popsicle stick. You want to try that? Sure.
Totally.
Yeah, let's try that. Oh, you think you might like this? Yeah, try it. And that experience, it's so funny. Like, whether it's Steirerweck in Vienna or an ice cream shop in Portland, it's the service that I remember so vividly. And that really just wowed me. And you kind of, I almost take for granted that the food is going to be good. It's not always, but in those experiences, if I didn't steal the menu from the French Laundry, I don't think I would remember half of these things that I ate, except for the iconic ones. Yeah.
When you look at that menu, do you have a sense memory for what it was like to eat most of the dishes?
No. The truth is no.
Especially the truffle agnolotti. Do you remember what it was like to eat that?
Remember the oysters and pearls because the dish was already burned into my brain and I was anticipating it.
Mm-hmm.
The agnolotti, I mostly remember one of the...
Wait, you did eat the truffle agnolotti?
Yeah, obviously.
Oh, sweet.
Okay, so you have to pick between a cucumber salad and truffle agnolotti. I don't know if you know very much. Hey, I like cucumbers as much as the next guy. I love cucumbers. And it was August in California. Why wouldn't I get a cucumber salad? Well, because there's pasta. Like, because I'm a starch freak. Because
there's $100 pasta.
Yeah. And I mean, what can I say about it? Taste memory? Like, yes, the pasta is supple. The truffles are flavorful. But what I, again, like going back to service, what I distinctly remember, and this is kind of like a kind of motif for the French Laundry and per se, is this idea of excess and indulgence, or kind of slightly moderated excess. But so they obviously shave the truffles over the pasta table side, like in front of you.
Yeah.
And they put on just a little bit, actually quite a bit more truffles than you expect. You know, they're expensive. Right. They're a premium imported ingredient, and they start shaving and they keep shaving. And maybe they even do it a little bit slowly to just like draw it out a little bit more. And you can watch the pasta slowly disappear beneath a entire forest floor of delicate of shaves truffle. Of black truffle. Yeah. And they do a few things like that where it's just like kind of like lay it on a little thick intentionally. Another example is that I don't know if it's still the case, but at the time foie gras was outlawed in California, so there was no foie gras on the French Laundry menu. At the sister restaurant in New York, per se, you could still serve foie gras. And they serve the foie gras with brioche. And they put the foie gras and brioche in front of you. And then someone in the background basically is watching you eat. and they make sure that when you're halfway done the foie gras, someone shows up, takes the brioche away from you, and gives you a fresh piece of brioche.
Right.
It's silly, but that's the...
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, in terms of actual flavors, like tasting something, I remember the oysters and pearls, the pasta, and the cobia, because I had never had that fish, and it had such a beautiful... The bacon wrapping was like very fine and
Applewood smoked bacon wrapped cobia.
Yeah, that's right. The applewood smoked bacon wrapped Gulf Coast cobia, yeah. Most of these others, I don't have a distinct memory of. In terms of the food itself. Yeah,
that's interesting. I do also have a couple of vintage menus kicking around. Mm-hmm. I should try. Yeah, we should do another episode and I should try and dig up some of my vintage menus because I do have a few things kicking around. But I come across them from time to time. And yeah, sometimes I really remember something that was on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just like, nope, I don't remember eating that at all. It's weird. Sometimes I think that pictures work better for me. When I've been in a lot of fancy restaurants, I have usually managed to take quite a few pictures. And so if I go back through my photo library and look at pictures of some of the meals that I've had, then I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that. Like, you know, I have a better sort of like... Yeah, better kind of sense memory for what it was like to eat in that place. But mm-hmm. But yeah, reading the menu, sometimes I'm like, really? I ate this? I don't remember eating this at all.
Yeah. Can I read you something else?
Yeah.
So this is not a printed menu, but this is eating somewhere and then either that night or the next morning, like frantically writing down everything that I ate.
Okay. To try and remember. Yeah. Okay.
And it's a lot, but I'm going to just like bang, 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 rapid read. Okay. Oyster. Okay,
sounds good.
Oyster. Lamb tartare with kimchi and seaweed cracker. Duck liver with almond cookie. Ham and cheddar pancake. Buckwheat pancake with beef tongue pastrami. Ricotta pancake with sauerkraut. Pork belly with plum jalapeno. Charred shishito peppers with goat cheese. Guinea fowl dumpling. Pork ribs with black bean sauce. Melon and cucumber with chili and creme fraiche. Cold greens with tahini. Anchovy toast. Pot de creme with fig and grape. Panna cotta with granita. Pear tart. Peanut milk. Tempura delicata. Yuba alla matriciana.
Wow. State bird provisions.
Yeah, that's right. And you ate part. You ate most of that stuff too.
Yeah.
So do you remember? Do you remember the taste? Like, do you have taste memories of any of those?
Yes, the ricotta pancakes. I have like a taste memory for for sure. Was there? Can you quickly go through it again?
Sure. Oyster. Oh, and you know, you know that you and I weren't actually sitting at the same table, so we didn't necessarily eat the same things. And I distinctly remember there was a fried sable fish wing.
That's what I was wondering. Right. Because I was sitting at the bar.
Yeah,
when great. I had that. Yeah. There was this. Yeah, there was like a sable fish collar that was like miso marinated, and then
is that like, what it was? I thought it was roasted. A fin.
Oh, fin maybe. Yeah. Maybe it was a fin. Yeah, and it was fried and then like
glazed,
grilled under a salamander, and it was like on the verge of burnt but not, right. And just like so crispy, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have a taste memory for too many other things aside from the peanut milk, which I will never forget. It's right. Crazy amazing.
Yeah.
Do you want to quickly go through it again?
Sure.
Now that I have that in mind.
Oyster.
Don't remember that.
Lamb tartare with kimchi and seaweed cracker.
Don't really have a taste memory for it.
Duck liver with almond cookie.
It's in a little pot. Yeah. It's in a little pot.
You scoop out
the duck liver.
I honestly don't remember.
I'm pretty sure I remember that.
Ham and cheddar pancake.
Right, which I may not have had. I don't think I did.
Buckwheat pancake with beef tongue pastrami.
Feels like something I definitely would have tried, but I don't remember. Mm-hmm.
Ricotta pancake with sauerkraut.
Yes.
Pork belly with plum jalapeno.
Not really. I mean, I remember eating pork belly there and it being good, but I don't really remember the dish like that. Mm.
Charred shishito peppers with goat cheese.
Yeah, not really.
Guinea fowl dumpling.
I don't really remember the format of the dumpling, so no.
Pork ribs with black bean sauce.
I think I do remember that. Because it's such a westernized Chinese dim sum dish. Mm-hmm. Like I have like a really strong memory of what I think that was like to eat that dish there.
Mm-hmm. Melon and cucumber with chili and creme fraiche.
Nope.
Cold greens with tahini.
Nope.
Anchovy toast.
Not really, although it's surprising. I would think that I would really remember.
Pot de creme with fig and grape.
Yeah, not really.
Panna cotta with granita. I don't have the flavors, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I don't exactly remember having it.
Pear tart.
Also don't exactly remember what the format was, so I don't think so.
And you talked about peanut milk.
And the peanut milk.
I did actually write state bird. So did we have the state bird provisions dish?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Hmm. Yeah, probably.
And then tempura delicata. Oh, sorry. It's quail with certain provisions, right? Like Meyer lemon and stuff.
Right. It's like a, Is it like a whole stuffed quail? I can't remember. Yeah, okay.
Tempura delicata. That's like delicata squash.
Right. I do remember having some tempura there that was crazy.
And yuba alla matriciana.
Yeah, I don't remember that, surprisingly.
I feel like this is turning into a conversation about like when you go out for food and you spend time and money and stuff like that, what do you really walk away with?
Do you know what I mean? Do you retain?
Because you would think, especially as chefs, that like, obviously, like these meals were years and years ago, so it's don't beat yourself up about it. But like, it's like you'd think that even as, or especially as chefs, that like what we would remember is the food and we would have taste memories of it all. But
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be like I'm looking at these, like I probably can picture only two or three of those things. Like either in my mind's eye or on my mind's palate, like it.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Like what I remember the pleasure. Do you know what I mean? Like I don't remember the, all the taste, but I remember the pleasure.
Yeah. I remember, you know, being at the restaurant and I remember what the service is like.
Yeah.
And I remember like feeling excited that I got to like choose from all these like weird options and order food off a cart and like, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember everything being good. I think that like, I don't know. It's funny because I think that like everything being good and everything, you know, having a surprising amount of flavor and really great textures and stuff, like aside from a few things, like the peanut milk that I have like a visceral memory of what it was like to have it. Mm-hmm. It all sort of like makes the memory of like it makes the experience memorable, but it doesn't necessarily for each dish like make that something that was indelibly like sealed into my memory. Like I definitely remember what it was like to go to State Bird, and I remember that I loved the food. But yeah, I don't remember every single thing that I had or why it was good or why it was impressive or why it, you know, made the experience more memorable.
Right.
But I do think that if I went to a restaurant like that and I was expecting it to be really good and then it wasn't, I would remember why.
Right. Yeah, totally.
You know, like, which is a weird thing. It's sort of like the quality of the food makes it memorable in a way that you don't mind if you forget or something.
Right. Yeah.
But if something is really bad, then you're like, then that just gets like flagged and you're like, not going to let that happen again.
That makes it, that's a kind of bleak way for a chef to look at their diner's experience, right? Because it's like the best case scenario is that they'll forget about this food. They'll remember they had a pleasant evening, but they'll forget about the food. That's the best case scenario.
I mean, honestly, Alan, like there is a topic that we have to broach at some point, and I should be adding it to my topics list right now, but I don't have it open in front of me. But like really, man, like I think when I was at the beginning of my career, I had a sense that like I was doing something like my career, the path that I was headed down was doing something that's very ephemeral. Like it's not going to leave a lasting impression, you know, like, and you know, there's a lot of in Hollywood movies, there's a lot of, and TV shows, there's a lot of talk about legacy. And I don't know if legacy and leaving a mark or something is all that important to me necessarily. Right. But I do think that it's interesting to hear people talk about that. And, it, you know, like, and it occurs to me more like when I see things that, you know, maybe friends of mine in other trades have made that are like, I don't know, you know, something tangible that is going to like, well, like, or, you know, my brothers did a lot of landscaping and they did some like commercial landscaping projects and like, you know, they laid like sidewalks and things that'll be there for like 50, 60 years or whatever. And, you know, there's a spot that they can like drive by and be like, oh yeah, you know, like I made that or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, for chefs, that's not really a thing. I mean,
Instagram, you know, that's what, for chefs, it's Instagram.
That's
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.